The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals, brought to you by IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement. I'm your host, Diana Simpson, filling in for John Ross, who has a tickle in his throat. Joining me today are Jamie Cavanaugh from our Minnesota office and Jeffrey Redfern from here in Arlington, Virginia. If you like this podcast, please do us a favor and leave a review on iTunes. Today, we're going to kick things off in the Second Circuit. Jamie, what is this about Jeffrey Epstein? I thought he was just arrested.
You're right about that, but this case is actually about access to judicial documents. So in this case, the panel was considering whether or not it should unseal documents in a case related to the prosecution of Jeffrey Epstein. And there were a variety of appellants here who wanted to get the documents, a newspaper, journalists, and even another gentleman who was accused who wanted to see some of the documents because he thought they could clear his name. And the district court here sealed all the documents and actually allowed the parties to kind of control which documents would be sealed. And that was kind of the major problem the Second Circuit found with the district court's decision.
What I think is interesting about this case is that whenever we talk about access to judicial records, it's obvious the reason that people want these records is because there are all kinds of salacious details that they want to report on. But that's not the reason that courts have such a high bar for sealing them. The real reason is because the public is supposed to have an interest in making sure that the courts are doing their job right and in understanding the law. And if we don't know how courts are making their decision, we can't really do that.
Yeah. And so one of the interesting things I thought about this whole thing was just kind of how this case came to be. And so, as Jamie, you were alluding to just a minute ago, one of the victims sued the government about this, the Crime Victims Right Act, where they're saying that this plea agreement that Jeffrey Epstein entered into in Florida, about 10 years ago, that plea agreement failed, the government failed to fulfill its obligations to the victims. And so they sued about that. They tried to get everything in under seal rather than having any of this out in public. And then they accused a bunch of people. And, then folks started to intervene into this particular lawsuit. And one of the individuals who was accused of being involved in all of this issued a press statement saying that what was said about her was completely untrue and that the claims were all obvious lies. And so then one of the victims said that that particular statement was defamatory. And so that's kind of where all of this came from. And so this is a very salacious and obviously newsworthy issue, particularly right now, as all of this is going on with his arrest in New York and what's going on with the Miami Herald had that really long investigatory piece about all of this. And so is there kind of like a one takeaway from this that you got, Jamie?
The main takeaway is that the court needs to be engaged here. It can't kind of abdicate its responsibility to review the documents and just tell the parties, decide what should be sealed. Again, like we were saying, there's this presumption of access to judicial documents, and that's very important to our whole justice system. And so the Second Circuit really said, there has to be an individualized review of each document to justify sealing those documents.
Yeah, and I think one of the lessons here for litigants is that this is a case where both parties agreed that they didn't want these documents to be public. And if you have a dispute where you really want to keep all of your dirty laundry secret, the only way you can guarantee that you're going to be able to do that is if you arbitrate. If you go to the courts, those are government institutions, and you don't get to tell courts how to do their job.
So is the upshot that we get to see these documents soon?
So the documents related to the motion for summary judgment were ordered unsealed. So yes, those should be available. But the documents relating to other disputes will be reviewed again by the district court.
Yeah, Jeff?
One thing I just want to flag that I really love about this decision is there's this little cautionary note at the end where the court says, even though we're releasing this, that doesn't mean that you should take all of these documents as true. You still need to be critical readers and exercise some judgment when you decide what these documents mean. And I think that that's a really good reminder because a lot of Americans have this I think, unfortunate tendency to treat courts as our sort of civic conscience. And if a court says something's okay, then that means that we don't need to think about whether there are any other related moral obligations of citizenship. I was actually at a city planning commission meeting just this week where they were talking about using eminent domain and potentially taking a property owned by a small business. And one of the commissioners actually said, well, eminent domain is a big thorny issue, but this is going to go to the court and the court will tell us if it's good or not, which is, of course, not the case. The court will tell you if it's legal, but that doesn't mean that it's fair or just. And I think it's nice to see courts reminding people that they have a job to decide whether something is good or just as well.
Indeed. All right. Well, moving on to Boston and the First Circuit. Jeff, what can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this case, Shurtleff v. City of Boston, I'm not sure if Shurtleff is how you pronounce it, concerned three flagpoles out in front of the City Hall in Boston. One of these flagpoles always flies the U.S. flag. One always flies the Massachusetts flag. And then there's this third one that usually flies the City of Boston's flag, but occasionally it hosts so-called guest flags. So sometimes that's flags from other countries. One time it was an LGBT rainbow flag. It's been a flag for a civic organization. And if you want to fly your own flag, you can apply for a permit to do so. So this plaintiff, he wanted to fly a what he called a Christian flag. I don't know what that looks like, but apparently it celebrates the country's Judeo-Christian heritage, as he put it. The city said he can't because they have a policy of not flying religious flags, so it denied his application. Unsurprisingly, he sues, and he says this is a violation of his First Amendment rights. So the real question here is pretty simple. Is flying the flag the government's speech, or has the government made this third flagpole a public forum where other people have to be allowed to speak and it can't censor them? So ultimately, the court said the flagpole was government speech. And the key issues were that the government has always traditionally spoken through flags. You know, when people see flagpoles outside government buildings, they just assume that that's the government's message, that this is just how reasonable people interpret it. And finally, that the government has always maintained control over the selection of flags that go up this pole. Now, what I think is really interesting about that is that it doesn't really come down to whether the government is intending to speak here. It comes down to how people perceive it, which means that the government might not always know in advance whether it's speaking or whether it's opened up a public forum. So these can be sort of fuzzy issues.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. The examples that the court relied on were license plates, which the message on license plates, we can all understand that's probably more typical government speech. And then also a permanent monument that an organization wanted to put in a public park, which would also make sense that a permanent monument would seem much more like government speech, whereas the question about whether or not a flag can be raised on a flagpole for one day for a specific event, you know, is a lot murkier.
One of the interesting things I've always thought about this government speech doctrine is that it's a relatively new development. It's Justice Breyer has kind of formed it, really, not single-handedly, obviously. You have to have a majority to create case law out of the Supreme Court. But, you know, it's become this thing that didn't really even used to exist. And the question I always have after thinking about what is and what isn't government speech or what can be deemed government speech is, so if this particular flagpole is government speech, that means that every time Boston raises one of those flags, that means the city as a municipal corporation theoretically is speaking through that flag. And so it is representing the position of the city. And so who then makes that decision? I mean, in here they talk about how there's a permit process. But, you know, if there's a flag commemorating Juneteenth or the transgender rights flag or the LGBT rainbow flag or whatever, you know, does that represent the city? And that is the upshot, I think, of the government speech doctrine.
And I actually think that this is not one of the closer cases I've seen in the government speech doctrine. I think most people, when they see a flag flying in front of City Hall, they assume that the city really meant to put it there. Actually, it's interesting you brought up the license plate cases because there are still some unsettled questions about license plates. The Supreme Court a few years ago said that so-called specialty license plates are government speech. So these are the ones that you can order that might, have a logo for a state school mascot or a military unit that you're a part of. They're distinct from vanity plates where you get to specify the exact message that you want. And it's still very much an open question whether vanity plates are government speech or whether that's a public forum.
That is interesting because they do exercise some control over what you put in there. I mean, I know that perhaps if some people find it funny to type in different cuss words on the make your own vanity plate thing and see what they'll let you get away with. And I know that they don't always let you get away with what you want to get away with.
The other interesting thing about this government speech doctrine, though, is that because the degree of control the government exercises is one of the factors courts look at, it's kind of a use it or lose it rule. So if the government is exercising a lot of control, then the government gets to keep exercising a lot of control. But if they start loosening the reins, then the court might say, oh, okay, well, now you've opened a public forum and you can no longer exercise any control.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the panel considered the fact that there wasn't a specific government policy in place about how the permits to raise a flag would be granted or denied.
All right. Well, wrapping up on the First Circuit, we're going to go then to our last case we're going to talk about today in the Ninth Circuit. Jamie, do cell phones cause cancer?
Well, that's still an open question, but we'll move on to the Ninth Circuit where the city of Berkeley has required cell phone retailers to provide the following notice to customers. So the notice says that to assure safety, the federal government requires that cell phones meet radio frequency exposure guidelines. If you carry or use your phone in a pants or shirt pocket or tucked into a bra when the phone is on and connected to a wireless network, you may exceed the federal guidelines for exposure to radio frequency radiation. Refer to the instructions in your phone or user manual for information about how to use your phone safely. So the question based on that message is, would a reasonable person think that your cell phone is dangerous to you after reading this disclosure? Is that the message that the city of Berkeley is asking cell phone retailers to convey?
And the Ninth Circuit said that that is an entirely acceptable disclosure to require because under the Supreme Court's recent decision in NIFLA and its older decision in Zouderer, the truthful disclosure of factual, non-controversial information can be required in commercial speech if it is rationally related to a substantial government interest. That's the test. So, as Jamie noted here, the real question in this case is whether this statement is actually factual. Now, this decision was over a dissent. The two judges in the majority said that every single sentence in this statement is technically true. And the dissent agreed. You can't dispute that each sentence looked at in isolation is true. But what he said was, you're missing the forest for the trees. Anyone who reads this statement, if they get it on a large piece of paper with their cell phone when they buy it, is going to interpret it to mean that cell phones are dangerous when they're in your pocket. And that's just not true. There's no evidence to suggest that.
So you had mentioned a little bit ago about NIFLA and Zouderer. What do those say?
Well, Zouderer is the original Supreme Court case about compelled disclosures in commercial speech. And it said that you can require truthful disclosure of factual, non-controversial information. The question that was left open after Zouderer was what kind of government interests are sufficient to justify those kinds of compelled disclosures. Now, some judges, including judges on the D.C. Circuit and the dissent here, have argued that Zouderer only applies when what the government is trying to do is to remedy or correct something that's potentially deceptive. But other judges, including a majority of the D.C. Circuit and the Ninth Circuit here, have said that, no, actually, Zouderer applies anytime it's related to a substantial government interest. Now, we don't know what a substantial interest is. It's supposed to be more than just a legitimate interest. But what I think's interesting about this decision here is that the actual interest being advanced to me seems just so slight. I mean, there's no evidence at all, and no one is arguing there is, that cell phones are dangerous when they're carried in your pocket. So there's no suggestion that consumers shouldn't really be doing that. Yet that is considered enough to require this point of sale disclosure with every single cell phone.
Well, the opinion kind of just says that as long as there's any public health or safety justification, the government is justified in requiring these types of disclosures. And that's a pretty scary standard to have, since the government often relates, you know, any number of things that are only minimally related to public health and safety to that goal. And another thing that's interesting about the dissent is that the dissent notes that the more the government requires kind of this over warning, this like too many warnings on everything, that the people aren't going to take these warnings seriously. It kind of discounts the seriousness of any of the warnings and kind of makes people just breeze past them. The dissent calls this the crying wolf problem and says that Berkeley shouldn't require any type of disclosure unless there's a real wolf.
Well, and this is one of the interesting things about all of this to me is the level of evidence. And so Jeff mentioned a little bit ago that there is literally no evidence here, and neither of the parties are suggesting that there's evidence supporting the idea that carrying your cell phone in your pocket is risky. And so if the government can justify a compelled disclosure requirement on this really on this public health and safety justification that isn't actually supported by any evidence, like everything is at risk. What's next? Are they going to start requiring disclosures for cheeseburgers or anything else that they deem inadequate or somehow riskier than some other thing? I mean, goodness, like you go to the grocery store and buy food, or you go to the furniture store and buy a dresser and you'll see like that sign that this item in California is known to perhaps cause cancer. And what does that even mean anymore? All right, well, that concludes today's show. We appreciate you. While you're waiting for the next short circuit, please check out our newest podcast, Bound by Oath, which just released a new episode diving deep into procedural due process. It's a good one, and I'm not saying that just because I'm in it. Until next time, we empanel you to get engaged.